how their labor fits in, how their, you know, volunteer labor fits into keeping society going, keeping everyone having a decent life and increased living standards. What do you do to those people? Well, you throw them in prison. No. The amount of social pressure on those people would be so intense. Imagine a society where it really did matter. Your livelihood and your having a decent life really, really did matter on what your people around you did and people in general did, right? In a way that you can really see concretely. And that stuff isn't going to the waste. It's not going to a few rich people. The wealth that you're creating is really going to the good side. And you say, you don't want to do this work that helps everybody? What is wrong with you? Can you imagine the social pressure on a truly lazy person under democratic socialism, where it's really clear that what you're doing has an effect, an immediate effect on everything? The value you produce in that society is not money value, but it's human value. It's human. It's increasing the abilities of humanity and the living standards of humanity, including your own. You know, do you really want to go back to the old days of unlimited, seemingly limitless amounts of work to create limitless amounts of wealth for a tiny few? Do you really want to go back to that? You want to go back to the wars and the pollution and the illnesses that people got that didn't have to get under capitalism? And most people are going to be like really, really angry, and I'm putting this mildly, really, really angry at the true people, the true, truly lazy, which I don't think really exists, right? But say there's some that prove me wrong. It's going to be numerically insignificant. It's going to be, okay, you go off there. I really don't want anything to do with you. Let's go back to tribe. Most of human history has been tribal societies. Right? How did tribal societies, these are societies without governments, without prisons, without, police, without all these things that supposedly you have to have for humanity to exist and survive? What kind of institutions you have are based on the economics that you have. So tribal societies really depended on each other to survive, right? It was kind of a form of pre-communism or something, a form of where there was equality, but it was equality based on subsistence. The equality of socialism would be based on abundance, not subsistence. But anyway, so the subsistence of the tribal society meant that every person had a role to play that was really valued in the tribe. But then there would be things that would happen still under tribal society. It wasn't complete, you know, and it wasn't like, I'm not trying to paint an idyllic picture, because it was based on subsistence, so there would be problems at times, there'd be problems with other tribes and so on. But again, you look at the tribal societies until they started to transition into slave societies. But where they did, tribal societies tended to the conflicts were muted, not as horrible as they were later under class society. Because hey, you don't want to if your tribe your tribe could disappear if the war was too bloody, you know. So a show of strength and a way to work it out is the way to go if you don't want to lose everything, you know. Not a full-scale war, you know. Now, later, of course, there were tribal societies involved in full-scale wars as there was a transition to slave societies or feudal societies, mostly slave societies coming out of tribal societies. But for the most part of human society, in terms of time, it's been tribal societies. And that's a high level of interdependence and cooperation and equality. For the most part. But where something really bad happened, what was the main way of dealing with it? Again, without all these institutions of coercion that capitalism uses, what happened to the person that they figured had done something just so horrible they couldn't deal with it anymore? They ostracized them. They kicked them out of the tribe. So go off on your own. See if you can survive. See if some other tribe will take you. But you're out of here. I really think that would happen a lot if it needed to. It would happen. I don't mean a lot, but I think that would happen under democratic socialism. That basically ostracization from society, again, when back in a new period where people are less alienated and more into society, you know, voluntarily, more into being a part of society voluntarily, that they would be not want to be ostracized. That would be a really horrible punishment. Wait, what do you mean? I can't see anybody again. I can't be part of anything anymore. I mean, it would just be, it would be a severe, severe punishment in a way that a lot of people under capitalism can't imagine I mean, under capitalism, some people would be like, that ostracized the hell out of me because I can't stand this. I'll go off somewhere and try to survive. People try to do that. I'm going to go off the grid now. See you later. You know, different situation under socialism, under democratic socialism, where ostracization would be a really feared thing. And it would have consequences for survival, most likely. But anyways, before we get into like science fiction scenarios, let's... and we're not going to do that. That was all about, you know, topsy-turvy land, why the people that don't do the work are in charge of the people that do the work and so on. Some things to think about anyway. And we are at WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. That's our legal ID. Hope you got that. And we are also, we call ourselves Tufts Educational Radio, Tufts Freeform Radio. We're at 91.5 FM over the airwaves. We're at WMFO.org. via computer, and please listen when you get a chance. And this is Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. My name is Jeff. I'm here with you every other week, sometimes with Diego, sometimes not. And we've been on the air here for a long time, since 2006, I think it was, with different co-hosts or guests. But there you have it. And again, every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And I'm going to have to catch up on some paperwork here in a second. So I'm going to put in some music, but not quite yet. When we come back from our musical interlude, we're going to talk about some other things. I haven't decided which order yet to put things in. We don't have much time left after my long point about work, which is what it comes down to, really. Let's see. We're going to put in something from a band I've played a lot on this show, but I like. But what's the song that I really... there we go. There we go. Where did it go? There we go. We're going to start with that. New Model Army, Here Comes the War. Enjoy. We'll be right back.
Stories and ones about serial killers. They dream into a savage toy. She heard the siren screaming out across the city. We had three odd nights in succession. The riot season is here again. Dear Lord, lead us back to the valley of the shadow of death. Yeah! Here comes the war! Ah, here comes the war! So did you think we were born in peaceful times? The world in derby spinning around faster. Center cannot hold, like a whirling dervish spinning, spinning faster. Ah, the center cannot hold. On the Age of Reason! Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. Shooting those Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell of the tortured men. Remember Allende in the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy and the Cuban Sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color, the bullet you spray of lead.
Sandinista by The Clash from their album Sandinista back in 1989. When did Sandinista come out? Come on, people. 80, I think. Not 1999, sorry. Anyway, I'll double check that sometime. But you can easily find out more about The Clash, and I encourage you to do so. They helped me become a socialist, and maybe they'll help you become a socialist as well. Hey, November 30th was the anniversary of the death of Mother Jones. And we're going to just touch on who she was real quick, read a little bit from something she said. This is from, I'm going to be reading from a book that I encourage everyone to buy or take out of the library, better yet. Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnov. Zinn is now passed away, but they wrote or collaborated on a book called Voices of a People's History of the United States. A lot of people know about Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States. Very worth reading. There's some problems with it, for example, the original edition, the last chapter was a revolt of the guards, where he talks about a profound social change or social revolution could only happen if the middle class, the true middle class, or the people in upper middle class circumstances started to stop defending the system, professionals, law enforcement, stuff like that. I'm not sure he said law enforcement. I don't want to put words. It's been a while since I've read the book or reread it. But I remember knowing right away that chapter just kind of went against a lot of what the rest of the book says, that popular movements are what led to change. I guess Zinn was talking about, going all the way and profoundly changing society. But I still disagree with that. Other societies, other revolutions have been successful by overcoming the limitations of the middle class, and part of the middle class, real middle class, I'm not talking about workers now, I'm talking about above the working class. Some of them are thrown back into the working class at times, and certainly during revolutionary movements, some of them do become part of the revolutionary movement against capitalism in terms of revolutionary movements against capitalism that have happened, both successful and some that have not been successful. Also, I think that Zinn's book, and I would say this is a fair statement, and I was not friends with Howard Zinn, but I had two classes with him and had some discussions with him and when I was in college, and then would see him off and on at protests and stuff. Didn't really talk to him much then. But anyway, I'd say this is a fair thing to say, though, about people's history, which, again, is really worth reading. Really good book. Is that it's still meant to be an introduction, really. I think that's a fair statement. I think he would back that up. That if he was still around, that it's an introduction to deeper, hopefully, exploration and reading and activism than you start off with by reading People's History of the United States. And so, this was not a surprise to see come out, Voices of a People's History of the United States, later on, with Anthony Arnov, came out in 2004. Was not surprised to see that at all. And I know Zinn, for example, had plans to do a play, or he wanted to see a movie done of the Ludlow miners strike and the massacre of the miners in the Ludlow strike, LUDLOW out west. Anyway, getting back to Mother Jones, I believe that she passed away November 30th. Not sure, don't have in front of me what her death date was. But she lived a long time, I think 100 years maybe. Anyway, let's just get into what she believed in, though. And I'm quoting from the book here. One of the most extraordinary organizers of the labor movement in the early 20th century was Mary Harris, who took the name Mother Jones. Born in Ireland, she became an organizer for the United Mine Workers, and in her 80s, organized miners in West Virginia and Colorado. In her 80s. In 1905, She helped form the International Workers of the World, otherwise known as the IWW. Upton Sinclair, who, by the way, I'm just editorializing here, Upton Sinclair was a novelist, also a ran for governor of California, considered himself a socialist, unfortunately ran for governor of California as a Democrat, lost, should have run as a socialist, independent, but anyway. Upton Sinclair, and Upton Sinclair is most well-known for his, I don't know, is novel the right word? The Jungle. It's been so long since I read it. I would say it's more like a piece of sociological book, but let's say the novel, The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. So Upton Sinclair was so inspired by her, I'm back to quoting the book here, that he used her as a model for one of his characters in the novel, in his novel, The Coal War, which chronicled the Ludlow strike and massacre. Quote, all over the country she had roamed, and wherever she went, the flame of protest had leaped up in the hearts of men. Her story was a veritable odyssey of revolt, end quote. Now, here's a selection from an address Mother Jones gave to a mass audience in Toledo's Memorial Hall in 1903, as reported by the Toledo Bee. So you're going to hear some of this is going to be her words, so it's going to be the reporter, the article talking about her. And it's entitled Mother Jones, Agitation, quote, Agitation, the Greatest Factor for Progress, March 24th, 1903. Mother Jones, known throughout the country and, in fact, throughout the world as the Miner's Angel, addressed a motley, this is, the newspaper corporate media of the time, gathering about 1,200 persons in the Memorial Hall last night. The lower hall was packed. The gallery was full to overflowing, and some even crowded the steps leading to the building. It was truly a motley gathering. The society woman, attracted by mere curiosity to see and hear the woman who was one much famous, the guardian spirit of the miners, the factory girl, the wealthy man, and his less fortunate brothers, fortune, yeah. The black man and the white man, the old and young, sat side by side and each came in for a share of criticism. Mother Jones is an eloquent speaker. There is just enough of the down east accent in her words to make it attractive. And she has the faculty of framing pathetic and beautiful word pictures. Despite her 60 years and her gray hairs, she is hale and hearty, has a voice that reaches to the foremost corner of almost any hall, but is nevertheless anything but harsh. Fellow workers, she began, 'tis well for us to be here. Over 100 years ago, men gathered to discuss the vital questions and later fought together for a principle that won us our civil liberty. 40 years ago, men gathered to discuss a growing evil under the old flag, and later fought side by side until chattel slavery was abolished. But by wiping out this black stain upon our country, another great crime, wage slavery, was fastened upon our people. I stand on this platform ashamed of the conditions existing in this country. I refused to go to England and lecture only a few days ago because I was ashamed, first of all, to make the conditions existing here known to the world, and second, because my services here were needed here. I've just come from a God-cursed country known as West Virginia, from a state which has produced some of our best and brightest statesmen, a state where conditions are too awful for your imagination. I shall tell you some things tonight that are awful to contemplate. Perhaps it is best that you know of them. They may arouse you from your lethargy if there's any manhood, womanhood, or love of country left in you. I have just come from a state which has an injunction on every other foot of ground. Some months ago, the president of the United Mine Workers, John Mitchell, asked me to take a look into the conditions of the men in the West mines of West Virginia. I went. I would get a gathering of miners in the darkness of the night on the mountainside. Here I would listen to their tales of woe. Here I would try to encourage them. I did not dare to sleep in one of those miners' houses. If I did, the poor man would be called to the office in the morning and would be discharged for sheltering old Mother Jones. I did my best to drive into the downtrodden men a little spirit, but it was a task. They had been driven so long, they were so afraid. I'm sorry, they had been driven so long that they were afraid. I used to sit through the night by a stream of water. I would not go to the miners' hovels, so in the morning I would call the ferryman and he would take me across the river to a hotel not owned by the mine operators. The men in the anthracite district finally asked for more wages. They were refused. Anthracite means coal district, coal miner district. A strike was called. I stayed in West Virginia, held meetings, and one day, as I stood talking to some brake boys, two injunctions were served upon me. I asked the deputy if he had more. We were arrested, but we were freed in the morning. I objected to the food in the jail and to my arrest. When I was called before the judge, I called him a czar, and he let me go. The other fellows were afraid, and they went to jail. I violated injunction after injunction. but I wasn't rearrested. Why? The courts themselves force you to have no respect for that court. A few days later, that awful wholesale murdering in the quiet little mining camp of Stamford took place. I know those people were law-abiding citizens. I had been there, and their shooting by the United States deputy marshals was an atrocious and cold-blooded murder. After the crimes had been committed, the marshals, the murderers, were banqueted by the operators in the swellest hotel in Pennsylvania. You have no idea of the awfulness of this wholesale murder. Before daylight broke in the morning in that quiet little mining camp, deputies and special officers went into the homes, shot the men down in their beds, and all because the miners wanted to try to induce blacklegs, strike breakers, meaning scabs, to leave the mines. I'll tell you how the whole trouble started. The deputies were bringing the strike breakers to the mines. The men wanted to talk with them, and at last stepped on ground loaded down with an injunction. There were 36 or 7 in the party of miners. They resisted arrest. They went home finally without being arrested. One of the officials of the miners' unions telegraphed to the men, "Don't resist. Go to jail. We will bail you out." A United Marshal sent back word that the operators would not let them use the telephone to send the message to the little mining camp and that he could not get there before hours had passed. The miners' officials secured the names of the men and gave their representatives authority to bail them out of jail the next morning. When the next morning arrived, they were murdered in cold blood. These federal judges who continue granting injunctions are appointed by men who have their political standing through the votes of you labor union fellows. You get down on your knees like a lot of yahoos when you want something. At the same time, you haven't the sense enough to take peaceably what belongs to you through the ballot. You are chasing a will-o'-the-wisp, you measly things, and the bullets which should be sent into your own measly, miserable, dirty carcasses shoot down innocent men. Women are not responsible because they have no vote. This is the time before women had the vote in the United States, 1903. This is the time frame here. You'd all better put on petticoats if you like those bullets. Vote to put them into your own bodies. Don't you think it's about time you began to shoot ballots instead of voting for capitalistic bullets? I hate your political parties, you Republicans and Democrats. I want you to deny, if you can, what I am going to say. You want an office, you must necessarily get into the ring. You must do what that ring says, and if you don't, you won't be elected. There you are. Each time you do that, you are voting for a capitalistic bullet, and you get it. I want you to know that this man, Samuel Milton Jones, who is running for mayor of your beautiful city, is no relative of mine, no sir. He belongs to that school of reformers who say capital and labor must join hands. He may be all right. He prays a good deal, but I wonder if you would shake hands with me if you shake hands with me if I robbed you. He builds parks to make his workmen contented, but a contented workman is no good. All progress stops in the contented man. I'm for agitation. It's the greater factor for progress. Then we have the reporter jump back in here, the journalist or the editor, whatever, of the paper, the corporate paper. Here the speaker changed her attention to the society women. Let's see. This is good stuff, but... all right, I might as well finish it off just a little bit here. I see a lot of society women in this audience attracted here out of a mere curiosity to see that old Mother Jones. I know you better than you do yourselves. So I can walk down the aisle and pick every one of you. Pick up every one of you out. You probably think I'm crazy, but I know you. And you society dudes, poor creatures, you wear high collars to support your jaw and keep your befuddled brains from oozing out of your mouths. While this commercial cannibalism is reaching into the cradle, pulling girls into the factory to be ruined, pulling children into the factory to be destroyed, you who are doing all in the name of Christianity, you are at home nursing your poodle dogs. It's high time you got out and worked for humanity. Christianity will take care of itself. I started in a factory. I have traveled through miles and miles of factories, and there is not an inch of ground under that flag that is not stained with the blood of children. And that's where this quote ends in the book. And this is from Chapter 13, Socialists and Wobblies, from Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnos, Voices of the People's History of the United States. Check it out. I particularly like that part. I'm going to reread it again really quick, a couple sentences. I hate your political parties. This is Mother Jones speaking. Your Republicans and Democrats. I want you to deny. And then she explains what. Okay. Anyway, you want an office and must necessarily get into the ring, and you must do what that ring says, and you must. And if you don't, you won't be elected. Each time you do that, you are voting for a capitalistic bullet, and you get it. I want you, and then she describes the local guy running for mayor, and it leads up to the quote, you know, that is based on this speech. The speech is known for, I'm for agitation. It's the greater factor for progress. But she exhorts Republicans and the Democrats there. And around that time in U.S. history, there was a lot of local sort of labor parties growing up, and soon after this time in history, there was the beginning of the Socialist Party under Eugene Debs and so on. We're running out of time here, so we're just going to jump around a little bit, but hopefully not too much. I saw this article published on November 17th about something that we talk about on the show a lot, that right now the term socialist or left-wing is being used, even by some people that call themselves socialists and left-wing, unfortunately, in a really misleading way. It's basically taking, you know, progressive Democrats using left populist rhetoric and calling them the real deal, calling them socialists, calling them real leftists. Bernie Sanders, not a socialist. Just read what he says about socialism. He quotes capitalists. His idea of socialism is capitalism. It's somehow a myth about a kinder, gentler capitalism of FDR. He even mentions Lyndon Johnson, which, if you know anything about Lyndon Johnson administration, despite the Great Society legislation that came out of that time period, of increased agitation around poverty, and then the big mass movements that came later, soon after that, in the later 60s, mid to late 60s. If you look at the Democratic Party things that Sanders extols of FDR, of Johnson, even of Kennedy, you look at them in context, you've got capitalism, and you have actually some really horrible aspects of capitalism. For example, under the regime of FDR in the 30s, that only existed because of the apartheid, really, in the South, the Jim Crow terroristic regime of the South, run by the capitalists of the South and the Democratic Party in the South. The Democratic Party had a lock on the South at that time, and that was a big prop for the Democrats in the North to, including Roosevelt, to gain power and keep power and to get things passed in Congress. And no attempt by the Roosevelt administration to even weaken, much less destroy, Jim Crow, but only to profit from it, really. And Jim Crow is a code name. Not a code name, but like it's a name for that time, but really it's just really terrorizing the black population, creating cheap wage slavery, cheaper wage slavery than even existed in other parts of the country. Even New Deal legislation meant to alleviate poverty was less money in the South and often not available to black workers or black working people in general. Sanders also, in earlier speeches prior to this election cycle, as they like to call it, he talked about socialism being countries like Norway, Sweden, Scandinavian countries in Europe, who are unfortunately not socialist. They are capitalist. They're just countries that, because of their position in the post-World War II upswing in the economy, they developed through actually communist, socialist labor parties, they developed a level of social welfare and a level of social benefits and a level of unionization that goes way beyond what we've ever had in the United States. Even the height of the Socialist Party in the United States in the early turn of the 20th century was not, or early 20th century, never became as mass a party as some of the social democratic parties in Scandinavia and other countries in Europe. And a lot of those parties started off as revolutionary parties. They had their goal of socialism. By the time of the post-war upswing, they were giving that up or had given it up. But still, the fact of having parties, and other parties came to the left of those social democratic parties, to have parties like those, and even the social democratic parties to a certain extent, allowed for a time, and that's disappearing now, a time that is disappearing, to have much higher social benefits and much higher living standards for the average working person than in the United States and in other countries. And again, that's ephemeral under capitalism. It's not permanent. It's precarious under capitalism. So to point that out, because capitalism was not done away with, capitalism still existed. So, for example, union density in Sweden, which had reached like 90% or 93%, I read one time, is much lower now. There's poverty, there's homelessness, there's problems in the countries that Sanders held up as socialist. They're not at all socialist. They just have a larger socialist tradition historically. That larger is a weird word, I don't mean to use that, a more effective socialist tradition up to a point, historically. Again, that's being weakened now. But so if Sanders really believed that, by the way, even if he thought that was socialism or near to socialism or better than what was happening in the U.S., then he would not run as a Democrat. He would be put all his time into building a workers' party that wouldn't just be just around him as an individual, but would be a ongoing party to the left of the Democrats that would take no corporate money, that would fight for a lot of the issues that he's talking about, but more, even more than what he's talking about. And in a way that would be, the party would be at least be anti-capitalist and would not get corporate money, or at least be severely questioning capitalism and not get corporate money, and not be ideologically subservient to the Democratic Party, not be trying to serve or hook up with the Democratic Party politically. That would be a huge step forward. It's not happening now. So I saw this article on Common Dreams, which is basically a liberal, commondreams.org liberal website that really loves, you know, uncritically supports the Democratic Party, progressives within the Democratic Party, or so-called progressives or progressives within the Democratic Party that are running as Democrats or had been elected as Democrats, not really looking too deeply into their voting records or into their what they ran on or what they say, whatever. So this one stood out because it is implicitly, from Common Dreams' standpoint, it's a reassurance to all the liberals out there. Oh, you don't have to worry about Ocasio-Cortez, who's the subject of this particular article, because she, you know, she's really just a liberal. Now, I agree. She really is just a liberal. Problem is that there are people on the left claiming that she's a socialist or really left. And there's plenty of examples in her, in how she's operated so far, that show that she's not. And again, I don't mean this in a personal way. She's struggling for some good issues, but struggling in the Democratic Party for those issues is the wrong struggle. It's the struggle that will just lead people into the Democratic Party, that will strengthen the Democratic Party, and has strengthened it in recent elections. And I'm talking about since Trump got elected. And things are not changing for the better. Even in a lot of places, well, we've made this point on the show before, a lot of places locally that say I've grown up in, or other people have grown up in, where the Democrats are the party, that's basically a one-party rule in a lot of major cities and so on. And in some rural areas, it would be Republicans, right? When you have that, I'm not saying that competition between those two parties means anything. It really doesn't, ultimately. They do have different positions on different issues, sure. But do they have enough different positions? Are either of them not corporate political parties? Are either of them controlled by working people? And the answer is they are corporate political parties, both of them. They are not controlled by working people. And they have a lot in common that comes out at different times. So even you had Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez voting, eulogizing the passing of John McCain, as a, you know, both saying what a good friend he was, what a great person he was, what a great politician, and blah, blah, blah. And McCain was just a horrible right winger, and in so many ways, in terms of foreign policy, in terms of domestic policies. You have the Green New Deal that everyone's using the brand of, when you read into it, that Ocasio-Cortez and Sanders talk about. It's got a lot of things, unfortunately, a lot of it is directed at corporations, not in a way that to hurt them, but to have them be part of the process. So it's a sort of a, you know, thinking that the corporations will be won over to, you know, green policies and so on, and put that over their profits. Statistics just came out that last year there was more pollution from fossil fuels than in previous years prior to that measurement. Despite all the propaganda, despite the climate marches and so on, which are good, the climate marches are good, but it's got to reach down into the working class. I mean, I think I'm quoting Chico Mendes, who was a Brazilian Marxist and head of the Rubber Tappers Union before he was assassinated by the by the cattle ranchers thugs, the big agribusiness thugs in Brazil. He said that an environmentalist who's not fighting for socialism is basically a environmental tourist or something like that. I'm screwing that quote up. Let me just put it in my own words, that if you're an environmentalist, if you care about the environment, you're not a socialist. You're not for the overthrow of capitalism and putting democratic socialism in its place. Then you're not an environmentalist in the true sense of the word, because it will take a huge international plan of production, and if that's not done democratically, it's going to be a form. It's not going to work, and it's also going to be a form of autocracy, a form of authoritarianism. So, a international plan of production, democratically organized and done, to create sustainable, productive processes and distribution processes and transportation and so on and so on, that takes socialism and democratic socialism. It can't be done under capitalism. It's absolutely impossible, where competition rules. You can't piecemeal regulate things that happen across national borders, that happen as part and parcel of capitalism. There was this movie called The Corporation that focused on a corporate. They wanted to paint. They wanted to criticize corporations, but then not go beyond the corporate capitalism, not go beyond the capitalist system. And so they focused on this one rug making company that wanted to become green. And by the end of it, only 20% of their production was at all green. And they self-admitted that. They admitted that because they wanted to stay in business. They had to compete. Anyway, back to liberals reassuring liberals, but leftists not understanding who liberals are. Now, I don't mean that personally, but I mean that in terms of political institutions in this country and political actors in those institutions. So from Common Dream, Sunday, November 17th, quote by Ocasio-Cortez, "I want to be part of the New Deal again," says the progressive congresswoman from New York, "the party of the Civil Rights Act, the one that electrify this nation and fights for all people." Well, let's think about that. Again, the New Deal legislation was very flawed, didn't go far enough at all, and was in the context of attacks on unions, severe attacks on unions, was in the context of racism in general in the United States, but especially propped up by Jim Crow and using Jim Crow and apartheid in the South to keep political power going. Also, the New Deal didn't solve, the New Deal legislation and the policy of the Roosevelt administration did not solve the Depression. That's something that even, even I think some supporters, some liberal supporters of the New Deal would admit, that it was really production based, excuse me, on World War II that created a situation of the recession, Depression finally lifting based on actually a lot of state expenditure, but on war. Let's see. They're just identifying where she's talking here. Oh, yeah, they're responding to this stuff that's getting pressed. We're going to talk more about this next show, probably. "As part of a wave of reaction to comments made by former President Barack Obama, who repeatedly suggested to liberal wealthy party donors late last week that some Democrats were going too far left, Ocasio-Cortez responded by saying progressives are not pushing in some new radical direction, but rather trying to bring it back to where it came from." Now, this is true. She's saying the truth. But you have to understand what that truth means. It means you're going back to the status quo of the Democratic Party over time. And you can look at any historical period of the Democratic Party in power and find the status quo was completely unacceptable to working people in general in terms of having a decent future and a decent life. And it was completely unacceptable to, it was completely intrusive and coercive and bloody in terms of what Democratic establishment, what they did to the rest of the world. And it's not a situation of sort of benign, like, oh, the Democratic regimes were somehow benign and didn't indulge in imperialism, didn't indulge in capitalist exploitation on a fierce level, didn't indulge in racism. Indulge is the wrong word. Of course, these were the pillars of those administrations, and they continued those policies. So she says, I want to be part of the New Deal again. Again, look at the New Deal. And also her choice of words of the Civil Rights Act. The party of the Civil Rights Act. Well, the history of the Civil Rights Movement is incredible pressure of a mass movement over many years, too many years, really, of putting pressure on Democrats and Republicans, but Democrats as well, and especially in the South, Democrats only at that time, and getting racism and oppression and repression in return, but having to build a movement that could no longer be ignored. And it wasn't just a movement in terms of what they teach kids about Martin Luther King, who himself was, many would argue, a socialist or interested in socialist ideas, very interested, who was not satisfied by the gains that were made. He didn't say stop with the Civil Rights Act at all. He continued, and because he continued to really try to change life for black people and really all working people in the United States, he was murdered for it, right? So there was not to look back at the Civil Rights Act and sort of not include at least a mention of how that was achieved and how it wasn't enough, is that's what's wrong with the Democratic Party. And she's admitting it here. Says the party of the Civil Rights Act, the one that electrified this nation for, and fights for all people. Well, it doesn't, but anyway. For that, many would call us radical, she said. She's right. It's not really radical. It wasn't radical at the time. What was radical was Martin Luther King turning against the Vietnam War, Martin Luther King doing the Poor People's March, Martin Luther King saying, no, the Civil Rights Act is not enough, Malcolm X saying the Civil Rights Act is not enough, Malcolm X not trusting the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, of course. Ocasio-Cortez concluded, we aren't pushing the party left, we are bringing the party home. Okay. Granted, that's true. She's telling the truth there. But the home is the home of capitalism and imperialism and racism. And really, you can't separate the history of the Democratic Party from the history from the Democratic Party now. As much as people have tried mistakenly to change it, activists, they get swallowed up in it. So you have everything from, you have the party of the slave owners originally, the Democratic Party, becoming this party that in the U.S., because the left has been weak and small and hasn't understood for the most part, they are always trying to play with the Democrats, the Democratic Party. And this includes many left groups. And they think they're being clever. They think they're splitting it. They think that they're taking people away from it. And in reality, they're bringing people into it. Both Ocasio-Cortez, through this speech, tweet really, small speech, and Sanders has said, Sanders has said recently, actually, I'm running to a great extent to bring people back, to bring the middle class back to the Democratic Party. So people think that Sanders has some great plan to split the Democratic Party and bring people with him and start some sort of new party, the left of the Democrats, both ideologically, programmatically, etc., they're not listening. They're not seeing the history of left populism in the Democratic Party. Sanders is not new in terms of left populism and progressives going into the Democratic Party. I mentioned one earlier, Upton Sinclair. He was a well-known socialist, well-known radical, very famous. He ends up running on a Democratic Party ballot line in California for governor and losing and throwing all that away. After that, he's associated with the Democrats. Sanders made the decision back in the 90s to throw his lot with the Democratic Party after trying for a while to be independent. The label independent for Sanders is a misnomer after 1992. Doesn't really exist anymore. didn't really exist too much in the late 80s either, but it was there. You could make a case for it. Doesn't exist anymore. When he says he's independent, it's obviated. It's canceled out by caucusing with the Democratic Party, raising money for the Democratic Party, voting with the Democratic Party, having a program really not really part of the Democratic Party in a lot of ways. There are differences. The Democratic Party is a large party, even just in terms of, there's no membership, so in that case it's a tiny party, almost non-existent, but in the sense of the number of politicians that use the brand, that use the money, that use the ideology, that use the label, that suck up to power and do what the capitalists want, Democratic Party is large. The number of capitalist politicians doing the bidding of capitalism in the Democratic Party is relatively large, compared to, in terms of political parties, because if you include local, statewide, and national, and so on. So, this institution, despite not having a membership, still functions at a certain level, raises money, has an idea, recognizable ideology, even in this case of left populism, which has happened many times in the Democratic Party, or progressive populism would be more accurate, really. People still recognize it as the Democratic Party. And that is helped along by propaganda that's basically false, calling the Democratic Party left. It really isn't. Anyway, she concluded this tweet with a new campaign ad for Sanders, who Ocasio-Cortez has endorsed. They campaigned together in Iowa, championing again for Green New Deal. I urge people to read into the Green New Deal legislation they have. They talk about. It's very corporatized, very much so. This is a liberal saying what I'm doing is liberalism, and I admire that that bit of honesty. And that should be understood, taken into account by people on the left, or that think they're on the left, that are, putting forward illusions in the Democratic Party through these progressive populists. If tomorrow, which is extremely unlikely, 99.9% chance against it, but if it happens that Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez broke with the Democratic Party and decide to help build a workers' party, that would be a good thing. Don't get me wrong. If a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat decides to start voting for a new workers' party in the future, if one comes up, which I think is probably going to happen, then that's fine, right? But what you do now, what you're doing now, instead of just speculation about what they might do in the future, is extremely important. And every moment that Ocasio-Cortez or Sanders have stayed in the Democratic Party lessens the chances they're going to ever leave. Or if they do leave, it could be one of these maneuvers where they're independent for a short time to come back into the Democratic Party to try the same old reform the Democratic Party thing that never works. Along the same lines, there was a good article, Social Movements Gave Rise to the Teacher Revolt, Not Bernie, from Aaron Dyke, D-Y-K-E, wrote this. And it was from, I think I mentioned this on an earlier show and couldn't find the source, and that's still true now. Also someone named Brendan Muckian Bates, who was a West Virginia teacher, and West Virginia United Steering Committee member in the teacher strike. Aaron Dyke, assistant professor of curriculum studies at Oklahoma State. They interviewed a bunch of teachers. They have a book called Rank and File Rebels, Theories of Power and Change in the 2018 Education Strikes. Well, I like to read that. Rank and File Rebels, Theories of Power and Change in the 2018 Education Strikes with Colorado State University Open Press. Article that I think I went into a little bit before, wanted to come back to, that basically goes into detail about where the West Virginia teacher strike came from, where a lot of its methods came from in terms of being a wildcat strike, breaking the law, breaking out of the clutches of the union bureaucracy to do a strike despite the university wanting to not really do it and wanting to end it prematurely, and gaining some good gains. Now, of course, history is being rewritten, and they're fighting against that because someone named Eric Blanc for Jacobin wrote, quote, how Bernie helped spark the teachers' revolt, end quote. And it really wasn't a, and this was from a book that this guy wrote. And they're just saying basically that's not true. This stuff predates Sanders, Sanders wasn't part of it, et cetera. And, but, you know, again, we're out of time, so I'm going to have to come back to this one again, because this is exactly what I'm trying to do now. I tried to do before and didn't get to it. We're going to put it top of the pile of things to talk about. Maybe we could start a little bit here. Again, it's a refutation to something Eric Blanc, B-L-A-N-C-T, wrote. In Eric Blanc's recent article for Jack Mintel, How Bernie Helped Spark the Teacher Revolt, Blanc condenses one of the primary claims he recently made in his book, Red State Revolt, that Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential run is one of the singular reasons for the recent resurgence of educator militancy. Such a claim is ultimately harmful to contemporary educator movements because it short-circuits our understandings of the often gendered labor, historical underpinnings, and complex relationships that entail igniting, organizing, and sustaining these movements. What we need in this movement are public thinkers who can pose and contribute to questions that educator organizers are grappling with in their everyday work to produce knowledge useful for growing our movements. Making instrumental use of contemporary educator movements to forward a political candidate sounds a lot to us like a familiar strategy that many educators have already resoundingly refused through striking. So that's a nod to the Democratic Party. And all, if you do, all you do is lobby and the Democrats and so on, you get nowhere. Support the Democratic Party positions, you get negative results. In the following, we strongly disagree that Bernie Sanders played a central or significant role in sparking and sustaining the education strikes, while we appreciate his enthusiastic endorsements, which, by the way, followed the strikes, I'll add to that. Instead, we support that the involvement of many educators in intersecting social movements, including the movements for Black Lives, ethnic studies, labor and economic justice, and immigrant justice, among others, is what sparked and what will sustain the potency of the educator uprisings. Again, out of time. We'll come back to that. And yeah, we had a lot of other stuff. That happens every show. We had to get more into the recent strike wave. But we had to do the Mother Jones thing out of respect because Mother Jones deserves that. And we're going to go out now with some music. Let's throw something on from, let's see. Let's throw on... where did it go? We've been playing a lot of Ry Cooder on the show, and I don't see any reason to stop that. So we're gonna put we're gonna play Gentrification by Ry Cooder in a moment. If I can get the album, the CD out. Yeah, we're going CD here, believe it or not. Old school. And you've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And that 1 p.m. hour is approaching, so let's hit it, Ry Cooder, and keep up the struggle, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thanks for listening. Little technical difficulty here. We're going to get back to Ry Cooder in 1 second. And there we go. Yay, Roy. Ry. Hold on. Here we go.
Standing on a corner, spending my time, not of a job, not earning a dime. Lady steps up, says, I suppose you're a stylish young man.